Prohibition War is your mind. Fill your head with the knowledge you need by checking out this latest entry in the Russ Belville Show's Reformers Reader.
All right, welcome back, everyone. We are going to the phone lines now, where we are trying to speak with Dr. David Bierman, MD. He's the author of Drugs Are Not the Devil's Tools, and they just hung up, so I don't think they understood we were calling in. Let me see if I can reach them again. Dr. David Bierman, MD, with a foreword by Judge James Gray. It's a two-volume set of the history. Hello, this is Russ Belville from the Russ Belville Show. We're trying to reach Dr. Bierman for our interview.
Okay, hold on for a moment.
Thank you so much. Yep, that happens sometimes. We get a receptionist. But drugs are not the devil's tools. How discrimination and greed created a dysfunctional drug policy and how it can be fixed. And so we're not talking just about cannabis here. He's got cocaine, heroin, and alcohol also on the front cover. These come in both black and white and color versions. I've got the black and white version, but they are luxuriously illustrated. You're going to find plenty in here. Dr. Bierman, are you with us? Not quite yet. Okay, so this is a complete history. Volume 1, 2637 BC through 1969 AD. Volume 2, 1970 through 2015. And these are, for our listeners out here, these are full-size books. We're talking, you know, 9-inch by 12-inch maybe. And how many pages in this volume here? 288 pages, fully footnoted, by the way. You're going to find all the facts in here exhaustively footnoted. 288 footnotes in this book here? 290 pages, and like 30, 40 footnotes per chapter, 13 chapters. And the second edition is also 256 pages. And again, just...
Hi.
Hello, Dr. Bierman. Thank you for being with us. How are you? I know you're busy.
I am, but we're rescheduling the last patient of the day, and the other patient that I was working with has just left. So are we on the air?
Yes, we're on the air. Thank you, doctor. Thanks for being with us.
Okay, all right. Go ahead, ask me whatever you want to. We'll have a nice conversation.
Sure thing. Well, I was just telling everybody about your two-volume set here, and I got my copies. Thank you so much for sending them out. And I've been telling people that drugs are not the devil's tools. Is the emperor wears no clothes for all drugs. I mean, you've got it all in here, Dr. Bierman. How long did it take you to put this together?
Well, it's based on a course that I taught in the Black Studies Department at UCSB in about 2000. And then I wrote a little much smaller book called Demons, Discrimination, and Dollars in 2006. So in some way, shape, or form, I'd say about 14 years.
Wow. Yeah, it definitely shows, because there's exhaustive research in here. And just going through the first volume the other day, I decided I'd start with the first volume because, you know, I've kind of lived through some of the second volume. But with the first volume here, so much to be learning. You've got all these illustrations and cartoons and lithographs and photos and graphs and data. It's just really amazing. I recommend this very highly. And Dr. Bierman, in the subtitle, it says how discrimination and greed created dysfunctional drug policy and how can it be fixed? That's going to give me a few questions. The first of which is, which would you say had more of a effect? Discrimination? Because a lot of people have this idea that there's conspiracy theory and Hearst and all of these terrible people trying to prohibit drugs for financial reasons. But how much did racial discrimination play in this?
Well, racial discrimination has been around for a long time in terms of drug policy. And in this country, I would say the first group that was discriminated against were the Irish. The British did not think much of the Irish. They thought they were lowest evolved in terms of humans, so lower than Africans. And they certainly felt that they couldn't hold their liquor. The Irish that came over to this country after the potato famine had two strikes against them in that they were both Irish and Catholic. This is a country that is quite anti-Catholic and continues to be so. After the Irish, you then had the Germans with their beer, and there was a large percentage of German Catholics that came over after the Irish. They also tended to I think they were Democratic voters at the time, except the parties have so turned around, I can't say for sure, but there was some concern about their political power. And then we had the Chinese who, they had a big flood in China, and they came over here for the gold rush and to work on the railroad, the Transcontinental Railroad. And they were prized because they worked hard and they worked cheap. However, in 1873, we had the first Great Depression in this country, and the Chinese were seen as unfair competition to Anglos because they worked hard and they worked cheap. And in 1873, we had, if not the first, one of the first prohibition laws in this country, which was in, of all places, San Francisco, California, and it prohibited smoking opium. Now, that's a little bit odd when you consider the fact that about 75% of people who were using opium were women who were using it for, in the words of Lydia Pinkham, who made Lydia Pinkham's vegetable compound, which was tincture of cannabis, tincture of opium, excuse me, that it was for the treatment of women's unmentionable ills. And so we had all of this propaganda that serves as the underpinnings of the marijuana laws. And in fact, after the blacks were freed, then the laws were used against them. Cocaine was what they were sort of hung around their neck. It was said that cocaine increased the sexual desire of black men to have sex with white women. Strangely enough, it apparently had no effect on white men, white women, or black women, only black men. And then they also made this kind of an all-purpose thing and said, and those damn Jews are selling the cocaine to the blacks. And then we had the drug warriors who started in the late 1890s, early 1900s, Dr. Wright and forget the bishop's name, but they were involved in trying to get opiates made illegal. And in 1914, you had the Harrison Narcotic Tax Act, which was aimed at the Chinese and opiates, but in order to get the necessary votes to pass the Harrison Narcotic Tax Act, they had to do something to appeal to the states' rights Democrats in the South. And so they threw in cocaine in order to play upon the racism of the black or of the white Southern Democrats, and the Harrison Narcotic Tax Act passed in 1914. In 1918, you had the Berman decision, no relation, not spelled the same. He was a doctor in Spokane that wrote about 3,500 prescriptions for opiates, and they said doctors can no longer treat opiate abusers with opiates. And that was pretty much the start of outlawing the opiates. Interestingly, of course, the the most successful drug law ever passed in this country was the Beer, Food, and Drug Act of 1906, which appealed to the intelligence of the American people, and it said you must put the ingredients of your patent medicine on the label. And this caused the decline of many popular patent medicines, a lot of which their popularity was directly proportional to the amount of alcohol they had in them. So we had in 1910, Hearst gets into the act. Hearst was anti-Hispanic. You remember he gets credit for stirring up some of the animosity and hysteria that contributed to the start of the Spanish-American War. In 1910, you had the revolution in Mexico, and so you had a lot of poor Mexicans who fled to this country because it was safer, and they brought cannabis or marijuana with them. And Hearst started in vain against all of these Mexicans and against the marijuana. And then as the teens went on, blacks from New Orleans in the South, where cannabis had been introduced by sailors in the Caribbean in New Orleans in probably the late 1890s or very, very early 1900s, and then it had was prominent in the houses of ill repute in New Orleans amongst the jazz musicians who played there. And so they started moving up to Mississippi and bringing cannabis illegal in 1918, 1919. Then you had an increase in the use of cannabis, and most especially by blacks and Hispanics. And then we also began to have more discrimination against the Italians and the Jews, who were heavily involved in bootlegging. I mean, what we have found essentially is that by using the criminal justice system, we have made matters worse, not better. Anslinger was probably not responsible for the Marijuana Tax Act. He was a fellow traveler and an opportunist, and he was a raving racist. I mean, few of his statements can be said over the radio today. One that I think I can repeat is his allegation that cannabis was used by Negroes, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, jazz musicians, and other social undesirables.
We're talking with Dr. David Behrman, MD, the author of Drugs Are Not the Devil's Tools. And we're on internet radio, so we are not constrained in any way. We can say any Anslinger quote we want. In fact, we do a few times on the show. I guess basically the it's interesting you point this out, that it begins in America with the Irish, because a lot of people aren't aware when we talk about race in this country and whiteness that in those days, Irish people weren't considered white. And so it seems to me that the drug policies, in a way, have been a code of enforcing whiteness in this country. Would you agree?
Well, I think they're a code of enforcing European correctness.
There we go.
But you're right about the whole whiteness thing. In fact, the Italians were not seen as being white in the 1920s. And it's an interesting point as to what is white. There was an interesting case, which is mentioned in my book, in 1830, of one Polly Gray, who was aptly named, and this case was in Ohio, and at that time the law was that you could not have a black person testify against a white person in a criminal case. If they were the only witness, their testimony counted for zip. And I believe that this woman was convicted of burglary, and the person testifying against her was clearly black. Well, she was a mulatto and had the physical characteristics that were more white than black. And the judge reasoned thusly, and he declared that she was, for purposes of this case, was white, because he said the oppression against blacks was so severe that it should be limited to as few people as possible. Now, she's probably the last person in the country who had a drop of black blood in her who was considered white. Imagine how powerful black blood is. If you have a drop of black blood in you, you're black. But if you have a drop of white blood in you, you're black. So Barack Obama, whose ancestors are both Caucasian and African-American, is he black? Is he white? What is he? Who cares? And in the 16th century, that is when race was invented. And there's a book that I mentioned in my book called The Invention of Race. Prior to the 16th century, the bulk of slaves came from having your army being defeated at war, and then you were going to be a slave. So it really didn't make any difference whether you were green or white or whatever. And people did not identify by any particular race. They identified by their occupation. They identified by where they came from, but not by race. And so this whole mythology about race came about. I mean, if you look at the human genome, there's practically zippo difference between Anglos, blacks, Chinese. They're very, 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 very similar. The differences are minuscule. And to try to justify on some kind of scientific basis that there are different races is not possible.
Mm, Very well spoken, Dr. David Bierman, MD. He's the author of Drugs Are Not the Devil's Tools, How Discrimination and Greed Created a Dysfunctional Drug Policy and How It Can Be Fixed. And that would be question two. How can it be fixed? What can we do to fix this problem?
Well, that is the important point. That's the reason for writing the book. There's absolutely no reason to treat substance abuse differently than we would any other medical condition. I mean, if you have cancer, are we going to throw you in jail? If you have a problem with substances, why should we throw you in jail? You're not likely to be cured there. So what we need to do is to stop treating substance abuse as a criminal problem, and it been absolutely absurd to treat substance use as a criminal problem. We've had pretty good success with tobacco in terms of educating people as to the dangers and making treatment widely available. Probably the strongest thing that we can do in order to deal with substance abuse as opposed to substance use, and of course that's the other thing we need to distinguish between the two. But if you go into a kindergarten classroom, you can pretty much tell which kids are going to have problems later on in life. And the most likely reason that they're going to have problems later on in life is that they're coming from a dysfunctional family. So if we can provide parenting education and other services to families when their children are young, we're going to have a much better chance of having a far lower percentage of people that have substance abuse problems. Dr. Ira Chesnoff, who did some work both in Florida and in Chicago, looked at mothers who used cocaine during their pregnancy and compared them with the children of mothers who did not. He provided for the mothers who had used cocaine a whole panoply of services, including physical health, mental health, Head Start for their kids, job training, resume writing, skill training, a whole bunch of services. And what he found is that the IQs of the children of the women that had used cocaine during pregnancy who had gotten these services was higher than the IQs of the children of women who had not used cocaine during pregnancy, indicating that it is the disorganization in the family that is most likely to have contributed to this problem. Now, one of the other things that he found, which is really disturbing, is that the longer that you spent in the Chicago school system, the lower your IQ got.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm a Packers fan, so I don't know what I can say about the Bears fans out there.
I'm a Packers fan, too. I'm originally from Wisconsin, so go Packers.
Go Pack, go. And after further review, the Bears still suck. Okay, we've turned it all around. Dr. David Bierman.
Thank you very much. I hope you encourage people to go out and buy the book. It's got its own website, Drugs Are Not the Devil's Tools, or they can go to my they can go to Amazon.com and they'll find the book either place. And I think they'll find it a very, very interesting read.
Oh, I know they will. And my audience, who is all about looking shit up, they're definitely going to love this. So thank you, Dr. Bierman, for writing it. And thanks for being on the show again.
Okay. Bye now.
Take it easy. Wow, what a great discussion with Dr. Bierman. Glad we got to take it into those different directions. And when we come back, we'll wind things up here on Toker Talk Radio. That's right, we got a radical rant coming up from hour one that I didn't get to do. Legalize gay marijuana bars. Stick around.
You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation. The Russ Belville Show, the National Wildlife Refuge for Marijuana Unicorns.
At Herbie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest.